Hi everyone, I'm Jason Scorse and welcome to another episode of Dispatch from the Zombie Apocalypse. I hope everybody is doing great and having a great start to the week. Today's episode, I'm going back to the interview format, and I'm really excited about today's guest, who is the chair of the Terrorism and Nonproliferation Studies program at the Middlebury Institute of International Studies in Monterey. And it is Jeffrey Knopf, and he is an expert on terrorism, counterterrorism, and all sorts of issues related to weapons of mass destruction. And he was at the Naval Postgraduate School for a very long time before joining the faculty and administration at the Middlebury Institute, and is a real sober, clear voice on these big issues. And these issues haven't been as paramount in many of our minds under the Trump administration, because there's been so much other insanity and evil and chaos to keep abreast of. But certainly with all the saber rattling against North Korea and the talk of war with Iran and decertifying the nuclear deal with Iran, it's certainly in the background there. And it is something I'm actually quite worried about, because we know that when politicians are unpopular, one of the easiest things to do to get popularity is to launch wars and engage in military conflict. And that's a way to rally people's kind of jingoistic and nationalistic impulses. And so I am actually very concerned about this as Trump and his evil minions become more embattled in this Russian scandal and the various other scandals that they are engaged in. And so I wanted to talk to Jeff about this and get his take, but also to take a step back and think a little bit more broadly about terrorism's role in our society and our politics. It's been, you know, 17 years now going on since the attacks of 9/11, and really, terrorism has just dominated the kind of national conversation on security. And I think, you know, it has really pushed out other issues that I think are quite important, like climate change in many ways, and the amount of resources it's got, you know, from the two wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, and thus the counterterrorism budgets that were incredibly high under Bush and then stayed very high under Obama and now are set to increase. It's just something that we really need to take a look at, because terrorism is just one of those things that is used as the boogeyman to do a lot of things that people might not be able to get away with in other contexts, but they use the word terrorism and it kind of is a cover for all kinds of motives. Those of you who are around in the Bush administration probably remember the Orwellian terror alerts, and every time Bush and Cheney were kind of embattled with their various corruption and right-wing agenda, they would usher these terror, you know, alerts, red and orange, and it would kind of get the national attention and spook people. And again, it was a perfect way to cover up their tracks of their unpopular right-wing agenda. And so it's just something that has an outsized place in the American psyche, and I think obviously way too much of an outsized place, disproportionate to the actual threat. But that's what I get into here with Jeff. In addition to the issues of the day, we get into the larger questions of terrorism in American society and how to think about it. So I think it's a great conversation, a very important one, and I hope you enjoyed as much as I did. So without further ado, I bring you Jeffrey Knopf. Okay, so I'm here with Jeff Knopf to talk about fun stuff with terrorism and nonproliferation. Hi, Jeff. How are you doing?
I'm good, Jason. How are you?
Excellent. So thanks and welcome to the podcast. Thanks for coming on.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks for inviting me.
Excellent. So we're going to just cut right to the chase here. You know, the big thing that's on everybody's mind What about this increased risk of nuclear conflict with North Korea? Is this something that we should keep staying up at night about?
I don't know that I would stay up at night about it. You know, the risk is not zero. So, you know, one of my, I don't know, kind of pet mantras with people is I think we often tend to think in very binary terms, you know, all or nothing. So, you know, like there will be one set of people, oh my God, the sky is falling, you know, war is imminent. And another set of people will say, no, nothing to worry about, you know, nothing to see here. You know, and rather than go sort of 0-1 with this, I think it's more useful to think on a sort of 0-100 continuum. So if you go back a few decades, the risk of a nuclear war with North Korea was zero because they didn't have anything and there was, you know, nothing that could trigger a nuclear war. And over time, as their capabilities have improved, that risk gets somewhere above zero. I don't know that I can sort of put a number on it right now, but I would say in the last, you know, year or so, there's sort of two big things that have happened that have made it a little trickier than it used to be. One is that North Korea has really leapt forward in their capabilities. They have demonstrated through testing missiles that they now have missiles that have a long enough range to hit the continental United States. And they've carried out nuclear weapons tests that suggest they're also really improving their nuclear weapons capabilities. So if they aren't there yet, at some point very, very soon, they're going to have the ability to put a nuclear warhead on the top of a missile and hit the United States if they wanted to. Now, that doesn't mean that they want to do that, but just having the capability means, you know, that there's some risk of things going wrong. And then obviously the second big thing that happened in the last year was Donald Trump coming into the White House. He's really ratcheted up the rhetoric about North Korea. And you have a situation where you have sort of two individuals in power, Kim Jong-un over there and President Trump here, who really seem to get on each other's nerves and take things very personally. And so just the interpersonal dynamic between the two of them you know, create some reasons for nervousness as well.
So I'm going to interject something I literally just read in the news today, which will be, it'll be dated by the time this podcast airs, but it's exactly the type of thing I fear. And it's the wild card in this, which is there was something that came out about some U.S. Trump official who was kind of caught on record or off the record somewhere. And again, I'll say this is a rumor. I read it in a reputable news source, but I can't confirm this. But it doesn't strike me as something far from what a Trump official would say. And it was to the effect of, you know, some limited strikes on North Korea might be good for our electoral prospects in the midterms. And it's exactly that type of thing that I'm worried about, because there's nothing that gets people riled up and distracts than, you know, then fighting and killing and war. And do you think there's any chance that there's some truth to this, or does that worry you that you could see Trump and his people using military conflict as a way to kind of rally the base? So
yeah, wow. Well, your viewers, your listeners won't be able to see this, but my eyebrows shot way up when you said that, because I hadn't seen the news story yet. I'm stunned that people would even think about that or speculate in that way, given the risks. I mean, certainly this is an old, you know, time-honored technique to distract attention from domestic problems by stoking up a foreign conflict. And certainly right before an election, when your election prospects don't look good, maybe a very tempting time to do that. I can tell you, as somebody who you know, has taught some of the research literature on this topic in classes on U.S. foreign policy, the actual effects of sort of trying to artificially trigger this kind of a rally around the flag reaction tend not to be really big, and they tend to be pretty short-lived. So, you know, a typical president may get a boost of 3 or 5 percentage points in their public approval poll ratings, and within a few months it's gone. And if you do it too close to an election, you know, it also just, there's the whole thing of appearances, it can just look really cynical and kind of obvious. So I hope that nobody will be tempted to do this, both given the kind of stakes and given how unlikely it is to really have a big benefit. But, you know, certainly with this group, you can't rule anything out.
Yeah, true, true. Well, this kind of brings me to the larger question with the North Korea issue, and then we'll move on, which is, it has a kind of Orwellian tone, the whole thing, to me, because from my standpoint, and maybe you can, you know, you can shed some light on this, there's just no incentive for North Korea to make a hostile act to the United States. Obviously, I could see them wanting us to feel that they have capability, and they want leverage, and they don't want to be preemptively attacked because they want to feel that we could inflict damage. They saw what happened to Libya clearly Iraq. But in terms of them actually making a hostile move, and we're talking about an economy that's, you know, the size of, you know, Santa Cruz, California. I mean, it's, you know, obviously I'm exaggerating, but not that much. I mean, Silicon Valley, 40 miles away, is more than the entire economy of North Korea, yeah,
probably,
right?
Like many, many
within
times.
A few square blocks, yeah. Right? So we're talking about this two-bit dictator where people are starving, and, you know, they've taken a lot of their resources and got some very high-end weaponry, but just, am I missing something? Because it seems like there's just no way that the North Koreans would ever attack the United States.
You know, I think that's probably right. You know, there's a bunch of different scenarios for what could happen. And in the Cold War, this used to be called the bolt from the blue scenario, you know, that one day we'd wake up and for some unknown reason, the Soviets would just launch all their missiles at us. You know, and that kind of surprise attack, you know, unprovoked out of nowhere, they just launch a nuclear weapon at the U.S. That's, of all the scenarios for what could go wrong, that's the least likely. Because they have no incentive to do it. And although they are an incredibly nasty dictatorship, you know, they're not suicidal. Kim Jong-un, you know, is a classic dictator, right? You know, he wants to stay alive. He wants to stay in power. He wants to have a country that he can rule over and be dictator of. And there's no reason for him to do something that would be the one thing he could do that would almost certainly lead to, you know, retaliatory action that would destroy his country. He'd be dead and be no country for him or anybody else to rule over after that. You know, even that one, I won't say that the chances are literally zero, right? And the scenario would probably be exactly the mirror image of your last question, right? The North Koreans use their nuclear weapons program as one of their incredibly small number of sources of domestic legitimacy, right? In a dictatorship where everybody's totally miserable, you know, and the sort of national pride and military prowess is one of the few things they can do to generate some public support for the regime there. But for them, just demonstrating the nuclear capability is, you know, is really enough. So no, I worry, you know, the scenarios I worry about are much more scenarios where you get kind of a, you know, action-reaction cycle of escalation, where everybody's sort of ratcheting up the rhetoric and you start to lose control over events and somebody makes a miscalculation, but the kind of deliberate, cold-blooded bolt from the blue, that's the least likely scenario.
Yeah, that, just before we change topics here, I heard on NPR something that I thought was really fascinating, was that in the protests in South Korea, the biggest protests in South Korea are not against the North Koreans, but against the U.S. So it's clear that, you know, people, at least in the region, see us more as the hotheads than the North Koreans. And, you know, that's kind of interesting when, you know, they have literally, you know, their northern neighbors are pointing all these missiles at them and ready to, you know, obliterate them, and yet they don't see them as much of the destabilizing force as the U.S.
Yeah, I mean, the South Koreans don't, you know, if North Korea strikes somebody, the South Koreans don't think it's going to be them because they're fellow Koreans.
Right.
I mean, in part, you know, for the people who are at the more alarmist end about North Korean nuclear weapons, you know, that's one of the things they point to, is they think, you know, something that North Korea wants to use the nukes as weapons for a military attack, but they want to use them as a political tool. And one of the things they want to do with them is use them as a lever to kind of try to split South Korea off from the U.S. alliance, you know, by making it appear like it's going to be the United States who's the warmonger that's going to drag them into a, you know, conflict on the Korean Peninsula. So yeah, in some ways, if our government was a little bit more calm with its own rhetoric, we'd probably be helping our cause and blunting what the North Koreans are trying to do.
Interesting, interesting. All right, well, we'll all keep an eye out for that. But let's switch to a different part of the world and talk about Iran and the Iran nuclear deal, which, you know, from everything I can assess as a layperson who's, you know, reasonably well informed, it's the, you know, they are passing the kind of inspections regime. They're being getting this from the, I think it's the IAEA. is saying that they're complying. Mm-hmm. And then there's this kind of certification process in the U.S. But because Obama did it, and of course Trump has to hate everything Obama did, no matter how effective it is or not, that's not the criteria. It's just that it has Obama's name on it. He's doing the saber rattling and he's decertifying and et cetera, et cetera. So how do you see this playing out? Is there something to be alarmed with there? Do you see any potential that the deal can really unravel? And just what's your kind of assessment for kind of our lay audience trying to make sense of this?
Yeah, I mean, this is a really hard one to predict. You're quite right that the deal as it was laid out, kind of the letter of the deal, all indications are that the Iranians are complying, right? The deal was framed very narrowly. It was about basically impeding Iran's progress on nuclear activities that would pave the way for them to potentially get a nuclear weapon. And President Obama and his negotiating partners in what was called the P5 plus one, they deliberately kept the agenda really narrow. We're just going to try to solve the nuclear weapons issue because that's, for the outside world, the number one concern of most people. And there's a whole lot of other things that the Iranians do that we don't like. And we just sort of, put them on the back burner and said they're not part of this deal. So, people who are critics of the deal and who have substantive reasons for it, they tend to have sort of two areas of complaint, right? And one is the time limits in the deal. A lot of things have sunset clauses, and after 10 or 15 years, the Iranians get out from under some of the restrictions, not all of them. Some of them are permanent, but some were time-bound. All right, and the other thing is just they wish the deal covered more issues, and so, okay, Iran has stopped nuclear activities, but they're still testing their ballistic missiles. They're still supporting, groups that we designate as being terrorists, like Hezbollah or the Houthi rebels in Yemen. They still have a terrible, human rights record domestically. So people who wanted to sort of solve all those problems at once are like, well, but you didn't, you ignored all these other things, right? And now you're sort of holding them, hostage to the nuclear deal, right? We can't beat up, North Korea on terror. And my God, I keep saying North Korea. We can't beat up Iran on terrorism, or they might pull out of the nuclear deal and we lose the nuclear deal. So it's partly just, did you want a narrow agenda or a broad agenda? I happen to agree with the Obama administration. Like, this was the single biggest problem from our perspective with Iran, and this capped the problem for a long time to come and bought us a lot of time to look for a longer term solution. So I'm a supporter of the deal. I think it was the right thing to do. President Trump, even when he was on the campaign trail, was a huge critic of the deal. And I think the fact that in order to get congressional support, President Obama set up this mechanism where the president would have to certify the deal. I think it's every 90 days. Trump hates doing that. And so in the fall, he essentially kicked it back to Congress, right? He sort of refused to certify it, but he didn't officially cancel it. He didn't officially put sanctions back in place. And he sort of hoped that Congress would pass some legislation that would sort of make it so that he, Trump doesn't personally have to certify it anymore. And if that happened, he'd probably live with it. This Congress can't pass anything, right? He kicked the DACA issue over to them, and they haven't been able to solve that one. They're probably not going to be able to keep the government open. So, I'm not convinced that Congress is going to come up with some bipartisan legislation that takes it off President Trump's desk. And so at some point, he may just decide that he wants to pull the plug on it. What happens next is really hard to predict because it's not a bilateral deal. It's not just the United States and Iran, right? This was a deal that was negotiated with, Russia, China, Germany, France, the UK, and the EU, along with us. And every single one of those other countries is that they want to maintain the deal. They will not support President Trump in trying to cancel the deal. If you have diplomats from all of those countries still trying to implement and still trying to keep the Iranians in the deal, I don't know which way it'll go. Will they say, well, if the U.S. isn't in, we're out? Or will they say, well, this is still basically a good deal for us. We want to maintain good relations with the EU and the European powers and the Russians and the Chinese, and they'll stay in. And I think how that plays out may have a lot to do with what's going on in Iranian domestic politics at the time. Does President Rouhani feel like he has sort of the space to be reasonably moderate and sort of stay in the deal, or is he feeling pressured domestically and that he's going to have to react to kind of U.S. provocations by...
To the great Satan.
Yeah, I mean, you know, they love to point to the U.S. as the cause of all their problems. Yep. So, you know, it's a well-established playbook there.
It sure is. Great. All right. Well, those are the two kind of big nuclear issues on the table. So let's move to kind of a non-state actor question, or I think would likely be a non-state actor question, which would be this. We've heard about this potential of a dirty bomb, you know, coming into the U.S. I think most of the time they talk about it through a port, that's kind of the least protected. Someone would smuggle it on a ship, it would get into the port of Los Angeles or something, and it would blow up. It obviously wouldn't be a full-blown nuclear device, but it would scatter radiation. It would certainly be a huge economic thing. It would probably kill a bunch of people, but also just radiation poisoning, making a lot of places unlivable. So certainly a huge thing that would be very destabilizing to the West. And what's your thinking on that as a real threat? And where's the assessment of that?
I mean, you're going to get similar answers from a lot of these questions, which is more than zero, but it's not high. Right. So, I mean, there's something to worry about there. But again, it's not something that I think you need to stay up at night worrying about. So, you know, a dirty bomb is kind of the layperson's term for what specialists call radiological device. And the basic idea here, there's different ways to do it, but the standard scenario is you take what would be a conventional explosive and you put some kind of radioactive material near it, and by detonating the conventional explosive, you then distribute this radioactive material over some area. This doesn't have to be smuggled in from the outside. You know, anywhere that you can find a source that emits radioactivity, you know, and there are domestic sources as well as foreign sources. Some of the sources that people worry about the most are some of the kind of radio imaging technologies that are used in hospitals and medical places. You know, if those are not well secured, right, and somebody tries to steal them, you know, those could be used for a dirty bomb. You know, most assessments are that a dirty bomb wouldn't kill very many people, and the most likely way somebody would be killed would actually just be from the conventional explosion, because you're probably not going to get a dose of radiation that's high enough to be fatal. Some people who are close and are exposed to kind of the highest doses will definitely have an increased risk of cancer down the road. But the main effects are expected to be kind of psychological. People just kind of freak out because it's radioactivity. And then economic, because there'll be a really horrible period of cleanup for the area that's contaminated. The chances aren't super high, in part because we've gotten better at securing you know, radioactive materials, so they're harder to get. And in part because the number of terrorist actors who might really do this is pretty small. You know, you need people who have a certain level of competence and sophistication to be able to pull it off, right? And who are attracted to something like WMD, which not everybody wants to do. And then, you know, the other side of that is that a lot of terrorist groups are surprisingly conservative tactically. You know, we think of them as these incredibly radical actors, but they like to kind of do what works, you know, and, you know, it's so easy right now to, you know, put out a YouTube video, you know, radicalize some poor sucker somewhere and have them go out and buy a gun or drive a truck through a crowd or do something like that, that there's not really any reason for them to change tactics. That's something in the playbook that's still working. Mm-hmm. It's kind of like a basketball team that's running the pick and roll, and if they keep scoring points, right, they're not going to start running a different play until the defense proves they can stop that particular play. So this could happen, but it's not, you know, the different scenarios that are out there, that's not the most likely.
Okay, interesting. Well, I think that's a perfect segue into my next question, which, you know, here we are, you know, we're going on 17 years since the 9/11 attacks, and there have been almost no terrorist attacks in the United States. You know, I mean, really very few, and even a couple of them, you know, there's the one in Orlando where it's kind of inspired. I mean, this guy wasn't trained or funded from any, you know, it was just, he watched the video or anything. So it's pretty even loosely defined what a terrorist attack is. And so given how easy it is to kill people in the United States, I mean, we can't even keep terrorists off of, you know, no gun purchase lists, mm-hmm. right? And we have all these, quote, soft targets everywhere, malls and sporting events. The point being is, at the end of the day, I kind of look it back and I go, there can't just be that many people who want to kill us. Because they could have by now, you know, and obviously every death is one too many. But in terms of societal risk, am I missing something here? Is this all this stuff going on behind the scenes that I'm not seeing? Or mm-hmm. is it just not that many people really mm-hmm. wanting to kill Americans?
It's a little bit of both. So I think you're right that the number of people who are available to be recruited for this kind of jihadi style of terrorism is just not that large overall. You know, and as much as we've had all these debates about the so-called Muslim travel ban, vast majority of Muslims who live in the U.S. are pretty content with the quality of life you can have as an American, and they're really, you know, not radically against the American people or the American way of life. So it's a relatively small number. But just because the forms of destructive technology that are easily available out there are, you know, there's so many ways that you can kill people if you want to, that even if it's just a small number in relative terms, you know, you still have to worry about them, right? You don't want another guy getting his hands on a bunch of semiotic, you know, automatic weapons and shooting up another gay nightclub somewhere like the guy in Orlando. So even though the numbers are small, you still have to pay attention to it. But the other thing I would say is I think some of the things we did, you know, mostly in the immediate aftermath of 9/11 have contributed to making us more secure inside the United States. You know, better screening before people board airplanes, going into Afghanistan and basically disrupting Al-Qaeda so that they can't really function on the same scale anymore. Refocusing intelligence and the FBI on sort of paying more attention to finding signs of terrorist plots. I mean, there was sort of a set of things that were kind of obvious and practical, most of which we did within a year or two of 9/11 that have made us a little safer. And as a result of that, the international jihadist groups, you know, focus their attention elsewhere. So there's still lots of attacks. They just mostly don't happen in the United States, right? So there's attacks in Europe. There's a ton of activity around the Middle East still, some groups running around Africa, some groups running around Southeast Asia. It's just that most of the large attacks, you know, take place outside the U.S. now rather than on U.S. soil.
Right, right. Yeah, we definitely have the benefit, and we have historically, of being far away yep. with two oceans, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
There's something about geography that's in our destiny there. But that being said, that kind of brings me to this larger issue of the response after 9/11. And it's good to hear that some of the, you know, the policing actions and kind of prioritization and that those extra lines in the airport aren't a waste. It's good to hear that those are actually paying some dividends. But I think
I'm not sure we need to be as fanatical as right. we are, but it did make sense to ramp up the security a little bit.
Right, fair enough. I got my TSA pre-check now, so I'm pretty happy with that. But in my view, and again, this is, as I would call it, the informed layperson view, I think the big mistake was viewing terrorism as kind of a military thing to be tackled with conventional armies and invading countries, and that, you know, even you mentioned disrupting the Al-Qaeda mm-hmm. in Afghanistan, mm-hmm. which obviously made a lot of sense. That could have still been done in a very limited fashion. We didn't need to invade a country and occupy it for going on two decades to accomplish that. And so I guess, you know, the numbers here, just to throw them out, right? It's, we've spent upwards now between Iraq and Afghanistan of $6 trillion. Mm-hmm. You have, you know, thousands of Americans dead, tens of thousands wounded, let alone, you know, millions probably in the Middle East, if you include Syria in that number, who are at least dead and wounded. And it doesn't seem any safer. It seems like terrorism is, in fact, potentially worse in the Middle East. And, you know, Am I wrong to think, you know, you're in the terrorism kind of community, how do people see it? Do people think that that was the fundamental misstep?
I think a lot of people do. You know, from the beginning, we gave an overly militarized definition to the fight against terrorism. I mean, even the terminology that President Bush used, right, the global war on terror. Right. It's not clear that we should have said war or global. Right? I mean, it definitely makes sense to sort of fight against terrorism, and there are things we could do to reduce the incidence of terrorism and make ourselves safer. But there's a lot of different tools in the toolkit. And the military option, you know, isn't necessarily the most effective. And where it's misapplied, you know, it arguably makes things worse. So, you know, I'm more favorable about the invasion of Afghanistan than you are. I think that made sense to go in there and hold the Taliban accountable for basically giving safe harbor to Al-Qaeda. And to make it clear that, governments that, you know, let groups like that run around on their territory are going to pay a price. But Iraq was just such a huge mistake. I mean, it was just a disaster in every, you know, everywhere you can imagine. You know, it wasn't necessary to do it. It came at very high cost for us. It was a distraction from finishing the job in Afghanistan. And it arguably made the problem worse, right? I mean, there'd be no ISIS if we hadn't invaded Iraq, right? That group got its start among people who, you know, began as insurgents against the U.S. Occupiers of Iraq. So, you know, I think Iraq probably made things worse rather than better.
Could you just taking that, could you extend the creation of ISIS to the Syrian civil war? Would you say if there's no Iraq, there's no Syrian civil war?
That's really hard to know, because the Syrian civil war was kind of primarily a product of the Arab Spring. You know, so the question is, if there's no Iraq, you know, is there no Arab Spring? I'm not smart enough to figure out. Yeah. Right. I mean, the defenders of President Bush and the invasion of Iraq will want to claim credit for this, that, you know, one of the reasons for doing this was to sort of plant the seed of democracy in the Middle East and show that, you know, Arab countries weren't predestined to have these dictatorships. But I don't, you know, I don't think that was really the inspiration for what happened in Tunisia. But that's, you know, it was really Bashar al-Assad's fear of a kind of Arab Spring type uprising in his country that caused him to crack down in a way that then caused the domestic opposition to go to an armed insurgency rather than peaceful protest. And certainly the whole thing's a lot messier because then ISIS sort of swept in and took advantage of the power vacuum. But, you know, if they hadn't, Al-Qaeda would have. I mean, that probably plays out about the same way no matter what.
Okay, fair enough, fair enough. Well, let's spend another few moments on Afghanistan, though, because you know, you mentioned something about, you know, you are a little more supportive of that effort because you thought, you know, the price had to be pretty severe for harboring an international terrorist group. And that seems entirely reasonable to me. I've been hearing a lot about, you know, this kind of, we're at a stalemate there right now, and that there's, you know, that if anything, the Taliban are increasing in these rural areas and Kabul isn't safe. And there's this talk about that eventually there's probably going to have to be some negotiation with the Taliban. And the one thing that people have pointed out is the Taliban are, at least, you know, this is the claim, they've never been interested in anything really outside of Afghanistan, that they're really a nationalist organization, that they weren't the ones that attacked America. They certainly gave safe harbor. Maybe they could make a reasonable claim they didn't know that Al-Qaeda was plotting this stuff, and, you know, they were kind of sympathetic on the jihadist stuff, but hey, we'll leave them alone. We didn't realize they were going after you. How do you see that? Do you think, given, if you believe that it's true that they don't have these kind of international jihadist aspirations, could, I mean, it's sad for the Afghani people, obviously, because they're a horrible regime, but do you see a future in which we sort of do some kind of negotiated settlement and back out and kind of, in some ways, give some power sharing back to the Taliban in Afghanistan?
That's possible. I mean, I do sort of feel like Afghanistan has sort of turned into a quagmire. I don't really see any good way out. You know, at the time, I was actually teaching at the Naval Postgraduate School. So, you know, I was working with military officers, and there was certainly some discussion in the hallways about whether there was ever a scenario where the United States could have gone in very quickly, you know, overthrown the Taliban, chased Al-Qaeda out of the country, and then immediately turned around and come home and, you know, been gone within a year and just let the internal factions fight it out for who was going to actually rule Afghanistan at that point. You know, if we'd done that, there probably would have been a lot of hand-wringing about leaving a big mess behind and, you know, not cleaning up the Taliban. So it was almost a no-win from the beginning. But by not sort of figuring out a fairly quick way to clean things up there, we're just stuck now with an Afghan central government that, you know, doesn't seem like it's ever going to be up to the task of controlling and ruling the country in a reasonable way, and Taliban remnants that we don't really want to negotiate, but we probably will have to. But I think that's just going to be a messy situation for a long time to come. I mean, I think you're right that the Taliban per se is very domestically focused, and they have no particular interest in international jihad. The only caveat I would add to that is that historically they've gotten a lot of support from the more radical elements of the Pakistani intelligence services, who do have that more jihadi ideology, but again, I think more regionally. So the Taliban are not, they're not 100% homegrown. They're a little bit of, I won't say they're just a tool or a proxy for the Pakistanis, because I think that overstates the case, but they have ties with the Pakistani intelligence services.
That's a perfect segue, because that was my next question, was on Pakistan. Okay. And so Obama was famously said that this was the one part of the world that really kept him up at night. Obviously, they harbored not only bin Laden, and obviously mm-hmm. had to be aware of mm-hmm. him, given he was, you know, in a stone's throw from a major military base in a major city. And then Mullah Omar was in a hospital, I think, in Karachi, and they, you know, and died there in Pakistan, being, you know. And when the leader of the Taliban's in a hospital in a main city, that you, obviously the military knows about that. So clearly they're in bed with these people. There's a lot that's being said. And now the Trump administration, interestingly, right, is withholding military aid. And I kind of like your take on that. A, kind of the general kind of strength of the Pakistani threat. What do you know? You share Obama's concern? And then kind of maybe there this new move by the Trump administration, on its face value, maybe this is actually something sensible.
Yeah, I'm glad I'm not, you know, president or national security advisor, because in a lot of these things I would come, well, what should we do? I'm like, I don't know.
Nice being academics,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, Pakistan's a mess. I don't think that they have a strategy as a national government of being you know, Islamist or jihadi, or wanting to, you know, pick a fight with the U.S. But it's a very fragmented state. And so you have pockets in the military and in the intelligence community that do have those sympathies. And you don't have a strong enough central government to just really control them. You know, when I look at Pakistan, I mean, in a way, they're a great country for the subjects that my program works on, because they have both a terrorism problem and a nuclear weapons problem. But of the two, I would actually say that the traditional, you know, state-to-state nuclear weapons problem is actually the much scarier one. Pakistan and India don't get a lot of attention anymore. You know, we're so focused on North Korea or maybe Iran or Syria. But to me, that's still the single most dangerous place. You know, they still have unresolved border disputes, you know, long history of war with each other, a lot of animosity. You have a more sort of Hindu nationalist government in power in India now that's inclined to be more hardline, you know, in dealing with Pakistan. And you have Pakistan as a country that it's a little bit like the Korean Peninsula. You know, India's taken off and Pakistan's kind of left in the dust, right? They're still a very poor developing country, while India is really, you know, growing fast economically and becoming a player on the world stage. So they also just have that kind of jealousy of being left behind. And what's happened is, you know, both India and Pakistan have nuclear weapons. In the late 90s, they tested nuclear weapons and kind of came out from the basement and openly declared themselves nuclear powers. They still have an arms race going on. They're still both building up nuclear weapons. To me, the most dangerous part is when they talk about how they see their own nuclear weapons and their nuclear doctrines, what do we want to use our nuclear weapons for, what will we do with them? They have an almost perfect mismatch. So the Indians have a posture that is, you know, very deterrent in nature, And that kind of assumes that, you know, if you have nuclear weapons, you have a deterrent. And it's sort of all at the strategic level, right? And the Pakistanis are moving very aggressively towards developing short-range, low-yield tactical nuclear weapons and talking about them being available for use. And the dynamic here is that you have had terrorist groups. So here's where these two things mix, right? You had terrorist groups trained and supported by Pakistan cross the border into India and carry out terrorist attacks there, like the big one at the Taj Mahal hotel in Mumbai, and I don't remember what it was, 2008 or whatever.
I remember
right?
that.
And so India has reached the point of being pretty unwilling to tolerate this anymore, and so they have developed a doctrine that basically says, if this happens again, we are sending a large conventional military force into Pakistan to seize some Pakistani territory and use that as leverage to convince the government they have to once and for all finally crack down on these homegrown Pakistani terrorist groups. So the Pakistanis say, well, you know, we're small. India's got huge superiority over us. You know, if they invade our country, we're at risk of being taken over by India, and we can't stop them conventionally. So that's why we want these tactical nukes, right? We're going to develop these small short-range battlefield nukes, and if we have to, we'll just drop some nukes on, you know, invading Indian conventional military units to stop them. And the Indians are like, well, you know, once you start a nuclear war, we're going to retaliate with our nuclear weapons and wipe out your cities. And then the Pakistanis, well, we still have some stuff left over, we can wipe out your cities. And so each of them has a vision of how they protect their security that assumes that the other side doesn't mean what it says, right? That, oh, India, you won't really invade us conventionally. If you do, we can get you to withdraw with a couple of tactical nukes. And, you know, India's like, Pakistan, you're never going to use nuclear weapons first. We don't believe you. And if you do, well, we just wipe you out. Mm-hmm. Right. So that bad mismatch between the two contrasting nuclear doctrines in the two countries, you know, if you asked me where is the single biggest danger of something going nuclear in the world today, it's still South Asia for me.
Interesting. Interesting. And what about the Trump administration's decision to block some of this military aid because of Pakistan's role in the Taliban or anything? How do you see that?
Yeah, it's a lose-lose again. You know, if we keep supporting Pakistan, they'll keep not worrying too much about controlling the parts of their state that are in bed with the jihadis. You know, if we crack down with them, then they'll just sort of stop cooperating with us on the things where they still cooperate with us, like, you know, letting us use their territory to transport you know, materials into Afghanistan and stuff. You know, I'm critical of a lot of things the Trump administration has done. This one, I'm not, you know, I mean, something had to give at some point. So this isn't necessarily a bad move.
Yeah, that was kind of my assumption too. And, you know, as much as, again, I'm as critical of the Trump administration as can be, but I like to look at case by case. And this one at least seemed like it had some merits given the history. But again, it's the lesson that, you know, the U.S. doesn't control everything. We're dealing with other actors that have their own interests, and we're not we don't get to just pull the strings.
Yeah, and we have, you know, unfortunately our history with Pakistan is really bad. I mean, from the Pakistani point of view, we were the most fickle, unreliable ally in the world. Like, one day we like them, the next day we don't, then we do, then we don't. You know, when we you know, wanted you know, them to help us, you know, back in the days when we were supporting the Mujahideen because the Soviets were in Afghanistan, right? Pakistan was our friend. Then the Soviets withdrew, and then we're like mad at them for getting nuclear weapons. Then 9/11 happens, and they're our friend again. You know, now we're mad at them again. So, you know, the Pakistanis don't necessarily see this as a specific response to something they've done, and they have to change their behavior. They just see it as kind of typical U.S. fickleness and unreliability. Mm. So, you know, it may not have the effects the Trump administration wants, but on the other hand, I don't see how they could kind of just keep going the way we were going.
Yeah, fair enough. Fair enough. So let's kind of go back out a little, maybe kind of 30,000 foot view again and talk, you know, from my standpoint, I study climate change a lot and other issues that not necessarily from a security angle, but which have big security implications. And certainly the military, U.S. military has been pretty progressive in this case of recognizing them and actually doing something about it. And so, given the amount of money, you know, that we've spent on terrorism and wars or to that effect, you know, now people are talking about the rise of China and all that. But I like to point out that China is, you know, putting way more money into solar energy than into their military. And that, like, it just seems like we've missed kind of the big picture of the 21st century, and that, you know, and you know, I think the Congress just passed a defense authorization bill that was $60 billion more than what even the Trump administration had asked for. Like, it's like the money, like, we can't give enough money to the military while our infrastructure is decaying and we're not putting money into solar and renewables. And so, just, are we, again, in this issue, are we not putting this in its proper context and spending too much of our resources on this? Like, kind of, I'm kind of maybe setting this up, but I just want, you know, someone professional's take.
I agree completely. You know, I got into working on nuclear weapons issues in the late 70s, early 80s. You know, your listeners who are sort of old enough to remember or at least know their history, right? That was sort of when the Cold War kind of heated up again and there was renewed fear of, you know, a U.S.-Soviet nuclear war. And I thought I was picking the one issue that was the biggest existential threat out there. Like, if we don't get this one right, we're going to just destroy ourselves, blow up the planet, we'll all be dead. You know, this is what I have to work on. You know, and sitting here in 2018, I'm like wondering, well, maybe I should have taken on climate change. I'm not, you know, it doesn't quite have that all-out apocalyptic connotation, but we're on a path to really screw up the planet in ways that are going to be really, really bad. And we're doing almost nothing about it, as far as I can tell. So, you know, I know that there's a whole giant debate about whether it does or doesn't make sense to frame environmental issues like climate change as security issues or not. But if we just sort of take the security label off and just sort of say, you know, what are the things we need to be working on to secure our future? We need to be doing so much more on this. And yes, our spending decisions are definitely not putting resources in the places where they're most needed.
Right. And so, I mean, kind of following up on that, I mean, obviously the spending is kind of tactically the result of this kind of disproportionate amount of energy and kind of national psyche. But I guess kind of, you know, at some level, it's understandable. I mean, terrorism is, our brain is hardwired for, you know, the big animal coming after us with the saber teeth. And the modern terrorist fits that archetype, right? So I get it. I'm not, you know, I'm not blind to that. But it also is manipulated a lot, right? I mean, it's also used politically, and there's also there's racial connotations. The fact that most Muslims are brown skin, and we, you know, we have a kind of racial thing. They're also non-Christian, so there's the kind of, we're the most Christian and religious of all the advanced countries. So there's just a lot of undercurrents. Yeah. And I guess, trying to help me unpack this a little, how do you think we got to the place where terrorism is just such a disproportionate, outsized role in our body politic? And is there a way to kind of unwind this a little?
It's hard. You know, I've thought about this sort of a lot off and on over the years, right? And it's, I suspect probably you and I have some similar training here. We were sort of so trained in kind of rational decision-making, analytical techniques. You know, I'm kind of utilitarian or consequentialist in the way I think about things, and you know, anything which causes people to die a sort of premature, unnatural death, right? You just, a dead body is a dead body, right? And it's, you know, if it's disease, drunk driving, you know, nut jobs with guns, environmental disasters, terrorists, right? It's, you know, you just count the bodies and you put the resources where you save the most lives. But it seems like in reality, we don't do that. And so, I mean, terrorism is a real threat. They will kill some people. It's not an issue we can ignore. But I think you're right that in terms of how much of our attention it preoccupies and how many resources we throw at it, it's probably disproportionate compared to other things that also threaten people's, you know, lives and well-being. So I can, you know, I can think of a couple possible reasons why this is, but neither of them leads to a good answer, you know, solution-wise, right? You know, and one is that it is still a weird way of making cost-benefit decisions in that, you know, terrorism, when it comes from Muslims and they're mostly from outside the country, you know, there's no benefit side for Americans. We're not benefiting from anything that allows this to happen. It's just, it's all pure cost for us. There are these people, they're not Americans, they're not the same religion as most of us, they're taking advantage of globalization, you know, they're killing us, and nothing that allows us to happen provides benefits to us. You know, everything else people see a benefit from it, you know. I like having bright light bulbs and driving my big car. And I know climate change sucks, but I don't want to give up my car. Or, you know, I know that there's a lot of gun violence out there, but I'm a gun lover and I really want to have my firearms for personal protection or hunting or whatever. So where you're sort of, people are part of the problem themselves because they're benefiting from the thing that creates the costs. They're reluctant to give it up. But there's nothing that we're invested in as Americans that we have to give up to sort of take a hard line against international, you know, Islamic terrorism. But I think the other part is really much more psychological and not, you know, rational, you know, at all. And it does have to do with, I think, both race and religion, but maybe especially the religion thing where, you know, Christianity and Islam are the two big proselytizing global religions. You know, they're the rivals, and you have a lot of people with a strong Christian identity who are very threatened by the rise of this kind of activist, radical, you know, Islamist identity. It would take a lot of presidential leadership to even try to bend the curve on that. I think it has to, I don't know where else it could come from. I think it would have to come from the top. And it's just such a political, you know, nobody's going to want to say, you know, we've really exaggerated the threat of Islamist terrorism because when we went for re-election, they're going to get accused of being soft on terrorism and they're not going to take that risk.
Yeah. 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 It is. It's kind of a chicken or the egg, right? Because we want leaders who are going to, you know, do the hard things or anything, but then we don't reward them.
Nope. We sure don't.
Right. So it kind of comes back to us, right? We get the government we deserve. It's much more a mirror of us than we're a mirror of them. Well, maybe we can get into something a little more affirmative, and then I have one question I want to kind of end on. And that's kind of, if you could make changes to U.S. counterterrorism mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. nonproliferation strategy that you think would get us closer to this correct proportion, saner, what are some tangible things that you would do?
Yeah. I mean, the military will continue to be a component of it, so I'm not saying pull the plug on the military stuff. You know, we have people from a military background, we kind of familiar with this way of thinking, ironically enough, but you know, they would talk about it using the language of elements of national power, or I just like to say tools in the toolkit, right? There's a lot of different tools that we can use in the policy domain to try to do things. There's an old acronym, DIME, which stands for diplomacy, information, military, and economics, right? So even in that simple-minded thing, the military is only one of the four big tools, and in practice, we actually have a lot more than that, you know, law enforcement, intelligence, cultural exchange, you know, et cetera. So I think we've over-militarized, and what I'd like to see us rebalance and do more with, I don't know, maybe three or four of the other tools. So a lot of this, you know, it's a global problem. It's a transnational problem, right? These are people and ideas that cross borders, you know, and so to deal with them takes a lot of international cooperation. And I think we've done a lot in this area, but we haven't prioritized it enough. And I think there's a lot more we could do with diplomacy and international cooperation and sort of building coalitions so that we have partners and allies sharing information and working with us, you know, to do this. But to do that, you have to not be too divergent in your rhetoric and your actions from what your partners want. I think we've still, and I don't know how to do a good job, but I can tell we've done a bad job. We've been really bad at what some people have called the war of ideas or counter-narrative or strategic communications, but just like explaining our side of things, which shouldn't be that hard. It's like, you know, just killing people at random because you want to like change the world's religion or get revenge for something that happened to the, you know, Ottoman Empire back in the day. That's just really morally wrong and stupid. And the fact that we can't explain that in a way that seems persuasive to a lot of the world, I think is really a problem. So in part, we haven't had enough confidence and enough belief in our own values and our own institutions to just get out there and make the case for democratic values, civil rights, civil liberties, equality, freedom of religion, respect for people's lives. I mean, in part, you know, the things we believe in are a good, you know, message against why terrorism is wrong, and we don't seem to be able to do the message. The final thing we do really well, I mean, we do really poorly, is work with local communities. So the best source of warnings that somebody may be getting radicalized or hanging out with jihadis, it's often neighbors, friends, family members. But we come across as so hostile to the Muslim community as a whole that I think we really discourage people from, you know, just sort of saying, oh my God, I'm really worried about the kid next door. You might want to go check up on him, you know, and getting those, doing a better job welcoming community members so that they'll share those tips, I think could actually go a long way.
Yeah, well, clearly under this administration, we're certainly not going forward on any of those points. I don't think people are feeling less hostile from the federal government these days.
No.
So part of this podcast, the undercurrent of this podcast is to get political change and more liberal, progressive candidates in office. And we have some big elections coming up, as mm-hmm. we always do, mm-hmm. this year, and then the presidency. So taking what you've just said and translating that, what should we look for? And with the caveat that we're not looking for big 5-point white paper plans, but what type of rhetoric mm-hmm. do you think we should be looking for and rewarding mm-hmm. in the candidates that are running for national office, you know, that kind of align with what you mm-hmm. would like to see?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I mean, I will say that I don't, especially congressional midterm elections, national security and foreign policy don't tend to be big drivers of those, except under very exceptional circumstances, right? So this one's going to be, you know, a referendum on the economy plus people's feelings about Trump and the Trump administration. But I think there's still several things we could look for that would be helpful. You know, some of it's just tone, right? Do people talk in ways that are welcoming and inclusive as opposed to being, you know, dog whistles for particular groups and polarizing or divisive? Some of it is, I would say, we're going through a particularly strong sort of anti-elite, anti-expert, anti-intellectual phase right now. And I would just like to see some candidates who show more interest in and respect for kind of professionals and people who have expertise and who might actually have valuable inputs into how we do things. People who have some experience of international travel and show some curiosity about the world that aren't just insular and, you know, it's all about America. I think would be really good. People who can compromise, right? Who aren't, you know, I mean, bipartisan compromise is going to be hard to get because both parties have some distance to go to get there. But at least the temperament where you could imagine talking to somebody you don't agree with and looking for common ground, you know, we're going to need some people in government who can do that.
Excellent. Excellent. All right. Well, we'll hopefully, you know, have some candidates that meet that billing coming up that we can replace the current administration with. We're all working for that. And then I guess the last question is kind of a little provocative, mm-hmm. but just want to throw it out there. So, you know, who would you be more scared of in the U.S., an angry white guy or a jihadist terrorist? What do you think to you is a bigger threat?
Yeah, so I'm going to answer that question in two parts. I'm going to interrogate your question for a second first, but then I'll answer it. So it's the same thing I sort of said at the top, which is I try really hard to avoid kind of either or, zero, one kinds of things. So it's a little bit like saying, you know, which disease should we try to fight, cancer or heart disease? You know, it's well, don't we want to kind of find cures for both of those? Right. So, I mean, those are both risks, right? Kind of the stereotypical angry white guy with a lot of guns. We've had a lot of incidents in recent years where that's led to mass killings. Jihadist terrorists, same thing, right? We've had a lot of incidents where that's led to mass killings, so we should be concerned about both of those. If I had to make a guess, you know, for any average American, which of those two is a bigger risk? It's the angry white guy with a lot of guns.
Right. Yeah, because as we were saying, there's certainly been a lot of jihadist attacks, but not nothing in the U.S., much more abroad. So maybe I think it'd probably be fair in Europe to say a jihadi attack is
other
more,
way around, yes.
would be the other way around. So so that's fair. It's context dependent.
Yeah, yeah.
But for Americans here, I think it's just good for us to realize that, you know, an angry white dude's probably much more of a threat than your, you know, your Muslim neighbor.
And it gets to, I mean, even though sort of terrorism is one of my fields, you know, a perpetual debate that people have is, oh, what's the definition of terrorism and who's a terrorist and who's not? And is that guy that shot all the people at the country music concert in Las Vegas a terrorist? you know, we the classic definition defines it in part by what somebody's motivations are, right. And we don't know what his motivations were. So it's like, right. Does it matter whether we call him a terrorist right. or not? It was still a heck of a lot of people who ended up, you know, killed for, you know, no good reason.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I think, hey, thanks, Jeff. This has been a really good conversation, I think, to kind of wrap our head around how to think of it. Because for the lay audience, you know, we can't get into the details. We kind of got to make do with pretty incomplete information. So it's great to get your insights. All right.
Well, thank you for inviting me, Jason.
Excellent. All right. Take care. Okay, everybody. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Jeff. I thought that was really great to touch on all these things that, you know, a lot of us read in the news and maybe hear on NPR or other shows, but it's good to get an expert with his kind of breadth and depth on all these key issues that, if they don't keep us up at night, are still certainly things that we all think about and which are certainly important to society. And so the antidote I'd like to leave us on for today is to kind of strike a reasonable balance, right? So my whole thing here on the podcast is we have to mirror the society we want, right? And so we don't want the kind of far right, you know, hysteria around terrorism, which is, you know, used as a way for increased militarization and to distract from the far right agenda, and is really just used to divide and harm society, and not really, protection is not the main driving force here. But we don't want to swing all the way on the other side too, or some on the left who really, I think, belittle or kind of minimalize the threat from terrorism and think it's all just a kind of right-wing militaristic fantasy, right? It is a serious threat. It's probably more of a physical threat to people in Europe and certainly the Middle East than us. And it's important to realize that most victims of terrorism are Muslims and in that are not in the Western world. And it's a still really big deal in parts of Africa as well. And so I think we can have a sensible, balanced view of terrorism, that it's not, we all should, you know, hide under our bed, but it's also not something to completely be ignored. And that hopefully if more of us can take a more nuanced, sensible view, eventually we can elect politicians that share this view, and this can become more part of the national consciousness. And so with that, I hope you are enjoying the podcast and share it with your family, friends, and colleagues, and subscribe on Apple, iTunes, and Stitcher. And with that, everybody, have a great rest of the week and take care.